I didn't realize that Savage Dragon's at 231 fucking episodes. Mm-hmm. Issues. Well, dude, that is...
Yeah, that's a lot.
Fucking phenomenal for one man to write, plot, draw. Jesus Christ, that dude is a fucking machine.
Yeah, it is very, very impressive.
Dude, I'm beyond impressed.
No, I know he's going for 300 because he wants to take that Dave Sim record. Because Dave Sim did 300. So he's got to do 300.
So Dave Sim did 300?
300 issues of Cerebus, yes.
And he did everything on it?
He didn't do everything. Gerhard came in and did a lot of the textures. Like, he would like do the backgrounds and stuff. But Sim was doing all the figures and all the storytelling. And Gerhard would basically add production value by adding like architecture and heavy rendering on the shadows. Well, I'm still reading.
Yeah, but aren't you good?
So far, they're fine. They haven't become like the great works that they're revered as yet. But so far, it's an enjoyable Conan riff. Because the first phone book isn't as well regarded. It's well regarded, but it's the second, third, and fourth one, I think, that people really like. Church and State is the one that people like, really get jizz over. So I haven't made it there yet.
Why is that?
He reached a levels of complexity that hadn't been seen in comics up to that point. And my question is, am I going to appreciate it as a product of its time, or am I going to be able to appreciate it as something that's timeless? So we'll have to wait and
see. That's a very good point, because I did notice some stuff when I was going through these books that I kind of was like skimming did not hold up very well at all. I was shocked.
Yeah.
Because I remember at the time, I'm like, oh, this is fantastic. And then I was rereading, I'm like,
So it'll be interesting to see. I think that people don't talk about Cerebus as much, not necessarily because it lost its luster, but because Sim has been outspoken in some very problematic ways about subjects like feminism, women in general.
Oh, really? Was he kind of like a slap a low kind of guy?
Not so much that, but he views women as a void that sucks up all of men's creativity and life essence and shit.
Is he gay?
No, he's straight. A lot of people think he's kind of a creepy MRA kind of dude. So that's
MRA?
Men's rights activist kind of mentality.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I don't know that he is. I'm saying that
I never heard that term, MRA.
Oh, you don't? Oh, MRA is a big thing on the internet, especially.
Men's
rights activists. Yeah.
Holy shit.
Oh, yeah. So welcome to Spawnometer. I'm Diablo Frank. With me is
Senor Fix It.
And today we're going to discuss Spawn number 10. Came out on May the 11th, 1993. Other number ones that had come out around that same time were Deathblow, Bloodstrike, Shaman's Tears, Stupid, Youngblood Battle Zone, Tribe, Shadowhawk 2, the second miniseries, which ended up being incorporated into an ongoing series, and the Brigade ongoing series got started. We also saw the first trade for the Savage Dragon. The issue we're covering is called Crossing Over. It was dedicated to Don Heck. He was one of the guys who's best known for Iron Man back in the 60s.
Okay. I remember hearing the name, but no, I don't know who it is.
And I checked, he passed away a few years after this issue.
R.I.P.
This one is written by Dave Sim.
From what we've discussed, I know he's famous for drawing a aardvark.
Cerebus, the Earth Pig, yes.
That goes through very philosophy-laden, dreamlike.
Philosophical, politics, religion, satire, yeah.
Okay.
And one of the big success stories of early independent comics.
Black and white comic, I remember seeing it everywhere.
Got launched back in the 70s, lasted for a couple of decades, 300 issues in total. Of course, a big inspiration because Dave Sim is Canadian, as is Todd McFarlane. Because if you think about it, McFarlane thought that great comic book writers, were a better sales tool, the best possible gimmick to have on a comic versus foil covers and things like that, variants, that sort of thing. So he gets Alan Moore, who is, of course, one of the most revered writers of all time. He gets Frank Miller, same. He gets Neil Gaiman, who wasn't as huge back in the early 90s, but he getting big at that point.
Okay.
He was certainly very well regarded. I think he'd already won that sci-fi award that he got, a Saturn Award by that point. And then Dave Sim is sort of like the odd man out, because while he is a critically regarded comic book creator, he doesn't move the kind of units that those other guys did. So I think that being an independent success story and being Canadian probably played into his being picked to be one of the four writers.
My only experience with Dave Sims is going to Third Planet Comic Book Shop, walking in there. They would have the Marvel, DC, and the Independents were on the opposite direction on a smaller shelf. And I just remember that book was always very prominent. That was like the big book.
Was
like,
it literally the big book, the telephone?
No. I'm talking like they were still coming out individual issues at the time.
Yeah.
But it was a big deal because I remember there was Boris the Bear. There was a bunch of these little books. They would always have the pick of the week, and it was always at Cerebus.
Well, to a large degree, Cerebus created the trade paperback market. Between Cerebus and the Fireside books that collected a bunch of Marvel stories, those were like really the first trade paperbacks that were available in shops and helped to show the viability of the bookstore market for comic book collections.
I didn't know that. I just remember buying mine at Walden Books.
He came to our city in the early dawn, but though later he would be called the finest warrior to enter our gates, at the time he was but a curiosity. You see, he stood only 5 hands high, had a lengthy snout, a long tail, and was covered with short gray fur. He was, in short, Cerebus the Aardvark.
What'd you think of the cover?
The black and white?
Well, you got, it's black and white with that strip of color, and Cerebus is actually even saying, color.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of a nice little callback to his origins of a black and white comic.
And it's not that the artwork is bad, but you really see the stark contrast in color versus black and white. It really pops.
Well, they were doing digital color at the time, weren't they?
Sure. Yeah, I think Steve
Bolton was doing it. Yeah, so it pops. So at the time, Spawn is going through these little mini adventures, I guess, falling through different dimensions.
The first part of the writer series
is Alan Moore.
Was Alan Moore, and it was Billy Kincaid's trip to hell.
Yeah.
So Spawn wasn't really a significant part of that story beyond the delusions or the terrors that Billy Kincaid is facing. The second one is actually about
Angela.
Spawn fighting Angela. He gets drawn to the cape, and then something happens to him while he's trapped inside the cape. And
he appears. Yeah, and it picks up from there. And I guess he's in, I don't know, man, like a writer's world or like, I mean, the book to me was basically commentary on how comic book writers are treated. It really didn't feel like a Spawn story. It's basically him standing on his soapbox and preaching in comic book form what he felt.
I agree. I mean, it starts out, I am Spawn. I am not Spawn. I am Spawn, for I share all of his memories. I remember his my death. The skeletal face which haunts his days and his nights haunts me as well. Blah, blah, blah. And then, I am not Spawn, for I know many things Spawn doesn't know. I know the names of the two detectives who pursue him. I know when and how they finally meet. I know why they call the little one Twitch. I know the histories of every one of his friends and every one of his enemies. I know things about them that they have forgotten about themselves. When Spawn goes to Al Simmons' grave one day and strips away the sod and digs down through the dark earth and opens the lid of Al Simmons' coffin, I know what he will find there. So as you read, I think you get the strong impression that obviously this is a Spawn story. Spawn is an icon that runs throughout the issue, but he appears to be somewhat of a writer's proxy because the creators, I think not even just the writer, because I think Dave Simmons is a part of this, but Todd McFarlane, I think, maybe collaborated in presenting this. It's them, I think, giving their views of what Spawn represents and what Image represents in the comic medium at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and it was great imagery. I mean, you have that one scene of, I guess, the writers with hoods on their heads.
Yeah, they're talking about how they've got the multiple levels of hell and that there's level 7 and nobody knows what's inside. Erebus is what it's called. Spawn teleports into there and that's when he finds, I don't think it's necessarily the writers, I think it's creators in general. The talent, nooses around their necks, hands tied behind their backs.
That's a little heavy.
Well, I mean, it's intended to be symbolic and I think it's intended to be propagandistic. So propaganda is obviously going to have a strong element of hyperbole because you're trying to rouse people. That's the whole point.
Well, you're trying to trigger something. I mean, I saw that and the dialogue itself, the imagery, I guess what I would say is the imagery is really, okay, so McFarlane drew this, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, there's that one image where Spawn is standing there and you know who the heroes are by their arms.
Yeah.
They didn't get in trouble, I'm not sure.
He's in a cave. The creators are tied up on one side. On the other side, there's bars where there's all these arms reaching out through the bars. And
Batman, Superman, Thing, Hulk. I don't even have to look at Wolverine. I can tell you what they look like.
Juggernaut.
How they didn't get in trouble, I will never know. You know who they are.
Perhaps pointedly Venom's in there too, co-created by Todd McFarlane.
Yeah. So, I mean,
although, let's be honest, it's just the swole version of the suit that my exec designed for Secret Wars, but still.
True. Like I said, this issue felt more like a moral telling of what he felt, how creators get fucked and characters are. I mean, there's that one scene of Superman looking corrupt and evil. And
well, you know, that's the funny thing. I don't think that's intended. You've got Superman in a partial silhouette because they give you enough so it's clear it's Superman, but they don't want to get sued either.
Yeah.
And so he's smiling and he looks evil as fuck.
Fuck yeah, he looks corrupt as shit.
But he's not supposed to be evil, I don't think. Because what they're doing is Spawn is trying to use his powers, which are now unlimited this dream place, to blast through the bars to save the heroes. And no matter how much power he pushes out, he creates a sun. It's still not enough power to actually burn through the bars. And so Superman appears, and the other heroes are telling him, take our power. Take all of our power. Take whatever you need to actually get us freed. And it's just Superman trying to lend his power, and it still does no good. They cannot release the heroes from their entrapment.
If I remember correctly, he tells them how he can give him his, the Violator as,
You see the Violator as Blind Justice, which is a bizarre image.
Yeah.
Because it's got the Violator covered head in money. Complexion, but he has big, firm breasts.
He has a dress made of money.
Billions and billions of dollars. Yeah. Holding the scales of justice, and on one side of the scale is all the money in the world, and the other side of the scale is a heart covered in tears and blood.
Oh, dude, this is so fucking heavy-handed. Ugh. I vaguely remember there's a scene where, doesn't he promise him he can find happiness, that he'll give Spawn happiness?
You really should have read the issue before you did this discussion.
No, there is. We give him the little...
Right, well, okay. So basically, Violator is taunting Spawn. Spawn for having failed to save the heroes. And I think the money's representing all the money that's being made through the creators' ideas, their dreams, that have been funneled away from them and given over to corporations. And the heart, the tearful heart, is the creators who lost out.
Oh, no, I get on that. Participation. I mean,
you see Superman also in prison saying simply doomsday. And I like how they note there's no fear in his voice, no despair. It is a simple statement of fact. And then all is quiet. The silence is deafening. The silence is agony. Just his awareness that no matter what they represent, that the justice and nobility these heroes represent, they're still imprisoned by corporations. Their creators are left as paupers, powerless to do anything with their own creations once they've sold them out. And then Cerebus appears to Spawn and basically leads him out of this purgatory hellscape, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Basically starts talking to him about, you can't do anything for these guys. I've been at this for 15 years. I know it's best just not even think about it. They go to Canada. They're in Kitchener specifically and passing through a bunch of locations that are familiar to Dave Sim because he's basically showing his neighborhood. And he walks Spawn to the mansion where Spawn lives with his wife and daughter.
Yeah, and he presents him with basically his dream life.
But what's interesting is it's not Spawn's dream life because the child is clearly a Caucasian with brown hair. Not for nothing, Cyan McFarlane, Caucasian with brown hair, about the same age as depicted in this comic book. So it's not that he's leading Spawn to this mansion where he now lives. He's leading Todd McFarlane. Cerebus is not Cerebus. He's a representation of Dave Sim. And Spawn is there being representing Todd McFarlane, but he's not actually Spawn. Spawn is a part of Todd McFarlane, but he is not Todd McFarlane. And it's showing that Todd McFarlane has the life that Al Simmons wants. He's got the wife named Wanda. He's got the daughter named Cylon. He's got the nice house with about 1 million hockey cards, which I love that Cerebus says while sort of rolling his eyes at the fanboyishness of that.
Dude, it's so fucking heavy-handed.
Well, the story ends with Wanda Blake, or Wanda McFarlane, however it happens to be. They even note in the story that it was his high school sweetheart and a real looker, which is true of real life as well. And the story ends with Spawn is trademark and copyright Todd McFarlane. Cerebus is trademark and copyright Dave Sim forever. Signed in this like cutesy font that looks like something Betty Boop would have had over her head back in the 80s at a Spencer gift.
Weird because McFarlane basically turned into everything the Sims character was trying to say. Oh, this is everything you're trying to say, and fucking McFarlane turned into it later. And it was worse because he was stealing characters and fucking over people and like everything he's trying to praise this concept of what Spawn is in only issue fucking 10, McFarlane turned into an issue like 190. Ah, dude, it's very preachy.
Well, okay.
I mean, I get it.
I kept trying to get you to give a synopsis of the story. You're already doing running commentary throughout, so you can't run dry now. Please pray continue. Okay.
I read this a while back, so from what I remember,
you read it a few months ago.
Yeah, a few months ago. I would say it was like my least favorite of the books because, like I said,
the writer series.
Yeah,
really? You just peek behind the curtain. You just finished rereading issue number 11.
Well, okay, you're right. I just finished. Okay, no, that's true, man. That fucking Frank Miller was horrible. You got me.
We'll get that next time. So your second favorite.
It wasn't bad, but it just.
So like, let's do this real quick. Okay, so we got a scale of 1 to 10, right?
Yeah.
Spawn number 8. Where's that on your
McFarlane
scale?
I mean, that's
Alan Moore.
Number 1.
Okay. Well, I'm only going to rank them. I was like more like a quality. Is it a 10? Is it a?
It's a 9.
It's about a 9.
Yeah, okay. It's very Alan Moore. He definitely put work into it. Okay, next one.
The game and issue.
A 9. Those were good.
They're on a par.
I mean, they're character building. I mean, they got a character. They gave you story. They gave depth to the character. They gave you a story of what happens to these characters outside of Spawn. Spawn is having his adventures. These are the adventures of these characters. I enjoyed them.
I think that the game and issue did more to build the mythology of the Spawn universe than probably any other single comic book that they ever came out with, including Spawn number 1.
Alan Moore's was by Billy Kincaid and the Hell, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. More, I would say Neil Gaiman is probably the linchpin in the Spawn universe because
he explained
how they hunt them. What
McFarlane had done to actually give it scale.
Yeah.
Like with Spawn, it's like, I was a Black Ops agent. I cut a deal with the devil to come back to visit my wife, and that's sort of where it ends.
Yeah.
I don't really need greater detail than that. The forces of hell are going to try to push them to do what they want to do.
But even then, you're not sure of what he is in hell. Like, you just know that Malbolgia sent him back and that's it. You don't know he's a soldier. You don't know he's part of an army. But you didn't know there's consequences to him not achieving his goal.
You don't know who he's going to fight. You don't know what kind of army he's companing. You don't know what are the consequences of running out.
I mean, at this point, dude, all we had him fighting were fucking mob robots.
It definitely expanded Spawn considerably.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's why it's important. So what's number on this issue?
It's not a Spawn issue, though. That's the thing.
He's on almost every page.
Yeah, but it's more a commentary about, well, this is what I feel about the industry, and this isn't this. And it's more of a, I'm on a soapbox, and I want to tell you a story of what I feel, but I'm going to make it with cute characters. You know, it's like if Mickey Mouse were to do a VD commercial and shit for kids to get it. So, I get that he's trying to show you behind the curtain with his character and Todd McFarlane's character, but it's kind of heavy-handed where at the end he's like, you know, oh, look, here's your daughter, and here's your life, and all this money. Let's be honest. I mean, McFarlane became exactly what the other companies began. You know, it's just money and power corrupted him. He got corrupted later on down the line. I've never read any of the Sim stuff, so I have nothing to go on. You've told me about it, how you're reading the books. I remember seeing it. I remember thinking the artwork was pretty cool looking, but there was nothing there to like draw me in. I mean, it's a fucking Art Bark swinging a sword, killing things. Yeah, I'm not into that. That's just not my bag. I think Dark Horse would release like little issues, like those multi issues where they kind of give you a taste of it. And I think I've read a couple of those and never really got into it.
It's funny because around this time they were pushing, I think he'd gotten through the first 200 issues and he was on the way to 300, and they were really pushing Jump On Now, or we're barreling toward the end of the story and everything. And McFarlane gave him his $100,000, he gave the other three guys, and it seems like shortly afterwards that's when Sim jumped off the rails, where he got really into the anti-feminism rants, the screeds about how men are the light and women are the void, and women steal the light from men, women take away their men's creative energy and robs them of their spirit and all this kind of bullshit. And then he lost most of his audience, and by the time Cerebus came to an end, he was actually somewhat in disgrace. He's never fully recovered from all those screeds because the industry turned against him. Comics still tend to be a fairly liberal industry, so for when you come out with those sort of controversial views, you're not seen as an edgelord, you are a pariah. And so by the time he hit 300, instead of it being a celebratory moment, he basically run the ship aground and was largely loathed. He used to be a pillar of the independent creator community. Guys like Jeff Smith used to go and eat at his house, right? And then I remember reading a story in a book that Brian Talbot, I think, wrote it, where it's basically a comic book confidential kind of thing where he's telling you the stories you don't get to hear. Oh, kind of cool.
I like those, yeah.
And he was talking about how Sim went on one of those rants in front of Smith about Smith's wife, and Smith like threw him against the wall and was about ready to beat the shit out of him. And Sim has contested that story, but that's one of those stories that are out there. So when you go from being a hero to guys like Jeff Smith to being a guy who's going to get his ass kicked by Jeff Smith, that's a pretty big turnabout. And I wonder if the $100,000 didn't do that to him. Now, Sim himself swears up and down that he's not a misogynist. And in fact, he used to correspond with a lot of his fans directly by mail. And basically, he told them that if you do not write a letter saying that you don't believe that I'm a misogynist or that I'm not a misogynist, I will no longer correspond with you. That's how far that went.
So he wanted a loyalty letter.
Basically, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so, that's first signs of an issue.
Yeah, and I do wonder if that $100,000, that security that's provided, maybe allowed him to go completely batshit.
Yeah.
And in the years since, he became like a born-again kind of Christian, but he's like a Christian scholar, and he believes in a certain strain that's all about celibacy and retaining like your chi or whatever the fuck. And so he doesn't get laid anymore. He reads the Bible a lot. He does a lot of charitable work, though. I've read where he will like read the Bible and give his exegesis on that for charity and shit.
Yeah.
He's done some good works. You know, he created the comic Judenhaus, which was about the Holocaust, and then he put it into the public domain so that anybody can print a copy of Judenhaus. You can put it out in classrooms as an educational tool against the Holocaust. And also, he, to my knowledge, he does not have children. He's no longer married. And the intention is he's already set it up to where when he dies, all of his works are going to immediately go into the public domain. So we're all going to be able to own Cerebus one day. But for now, he still controls the character. But because he knows that's the end game, there's actually been some people who've been working on a Cerebus movie for years now. They're trying to create a CGI movie that's going to be an adaptation of the first couple of years worth of stories, taking bits and pieces. And he's never officially granted them the license to do that. But he's also said he will not take any legal action against them if they want to. So you can go online and watch YouTube. There's all these videos of the work in progress as they've been over years and years developing this CGI movie. So he's an interesting character, definitely a divisive character. And it's weird to me thinking about what impact McFarlane may have had on that occurring.
Mm-hmm. Huh, that's pretty cool. Actually, that's really cool.
But onto this issue specifically, easily my favorite issue of Spawn ever, easily one of my favorite Image comics ever, and among my favorite comic books. Because I wouldn't say this comic shaped my view of comics. I was already aware of the travesties that have occurred, the injustices visited upon creators by this point in time. But I thought it did an excellent job as being a sort of a manifesto for why Image Comics exists, why it's important for creators to maintain their creations, to this day, those two creators own their characters. Todd McFarlane is now working on a movie. He held on to his rights. He worked on a script for years until it finally got to a place where he wanted to be. He talked to Hollywood producers until he could finally not only get the movie made, but he's going to direct it. He got the star that he wanted, and he's doing it all his way. No comic creator has ever gotten to do that with their own movie. The closest would be Frank Miller with Sin City, where he contributed to the direction that Robert Rodriguez did, but he didn't get to write the fucking script. He didn't get to fucking actually direct the movie. He only ever directed that one movie that nobody wants to talk about.
Yeah, The Spirit.
Right.
And maybe so, that's what McFarlane should take into consideration. I have a problem. I respect that he's like, I'm doing it my way. And I'm sure they're playing Frank Sinatra in the background for him. But that's not your forte, man. Like, okay, you did it your way, and it's going to probably be a shitty movie. I really do think it's going to be a shitty movie. I think he was really upset about the first one because everyone else did. Come on, Todd. I mean, you've been riding Spawn, this dead horse, for a long time here, buddy.
Well, let's not talk about the movie too much because we'll probably cover that in the Spawning Ground mail section, too. Okay. Some more. But you think that Todd McFarlane is probably a bit of an asshole. He's definitely obnoxious, and he definitely hates on people.
I mean, he's full of himself. I mean, he's one of those guys like, don't tell me I can't do it. I'm going to do it. And that's fine. But those people tend to also have that sense that everything do is great. And it's like,
he has some perspective. Like, he of all the Image creators,
what has he ever filmed?
One of the guys who's been most critical of his own artwork. I think that one of the reasons why he stopped drawing is because he doesn't have confidence in his own artwork.
No, he said it took him too long to do all the little detail. Right. It was his big
thing. But also, he doesn't feel like he could ever have the impact today that he had back then. He feels like the industry's kind of progressed past his style, and so he's very self-conscious that he just doesn't think he's good enough to be who people think he should be as Todd McFarlane.
No, I think he doesn't think he's as good as he thinks he should
be. But I think Eric Larson during his run, I thought it looked really good. I think he's done some really great works in Inker. I still think his artwork looks solid today. I don't think he's lost that much in terms of ability.
I
just don't think he wants to produce full issues of anymore either.
Well, no, I mean, I'm sure he's a busy guy. He has to be super busy, but I think he's also the type of guy that if he takes a misstep, it's going to be a huge shot to his ego. So he'd rather freeze himself in time at that nice little spot where he felt he was at his peak and just say, well, that was me and that's it and I'm not going to do anything.
Well, also too, the dude became a entrepreneur. He runs businesses. He's working on a movie. I think he's got other worlds to conquer,
busy.
And he wants to do some other stuff.
But being stuck
in a drawing board, drawing comic book is kind of a drag. I don't want to get too far away because we're running out of time. Okay. I just want to say that I love this comic. I love that it basically tells you the philosophy of Image, whether or not it's worked out in practice or not. It's like, look, as long as you're creating for these companies, you're selling your children, you're going to come up with some great creation if you're lucky. That creation is going to have a life on its own. You're not going to be able to profit from it. You're not going to be able to have any say over it. It's just going to be whatever the companies decide it's going to be, and you're going to be left in the dark, in the cold. No control. You'll have other people claiming that Marvel owns this. Marvel creates this. This is a Marvel product. This is a DC product. It's product, period. Whatever you have to say about Todd McFarlane, he still owns and controls Spawn. He still is invested in that character, has the obvious love for that character, and the Image model is absolutely the model. If you're a creator, if you're not going after that, if you're not creating creator-owned books, you're doing yourself a disservice, you're doing your craft a disservice, and you may never be able to benefit from your creations as a creator. And I love that this book is a manifesto for that. When I read this book, it makes me passionate. I want to read more Image comics. I want to read more creator-owned books. If I ever got to do comics, I'd want to do creator-owned comics because I would want to have that thing that's mine that I have as my artistic expression, that if I decide that I want to end or that if I want to alter, I can do that without some corporation putting a rubber stamp on it. I think that, you know, you look at a guy like Jim Starlin, I'm sure he loves seeing his creations adapted into those Marvel movies and everything. But at the same time, most of the creators involved with those concepts died penniless or died somewhat impoverished. They never got to go to Hollywood. They never got that love, that zeal. So many comic book stories have been adapted from creators that they get their name in the credits of one of those big movies, but they don't go to the Hollywood premieres. They don't get mentioned. They did the work. The work is adapted to screen. People are making millions, if not billions of dollars off this stuff, and they get nothing out of that. So however you may feel about what ended up happening with Dave Sim, whatever happens with Todd McFarlane, the ethos that they're espousing in this comic book does matter. And I do think it's an excellent manifesto, and it jazzes me up every time I read it. I love that comic.
Yeah. Like I said, I just read that, and then I realized that Todd basically turned into everything he swore up and down he would never be.
And I'm not sure if that's entirely true. I think there's elements of that.
He's been sued. He's screwed over people. He's screwed over artists. He's stolen likeness. I mean, he's...
I think he's made mistakes, obviously. And
I'm not going to be a
Todd McFarlane apologist, but I also think perhaps he gets slagged on disproportionately, especially when you take into account the degree that he's had nonsense shenanigans in no way compares to any of the other big companies.
Oh, no, but they've been around, dude, 10 times his time. lifetime. I mean, he controls this stuff.
Dude,
since Kirby and them have drawn, they've all got screwed.
How many of those guys got?
Oh, no, they all got screwed. They all got screwed. Yeah. I mean, we watched that documentary about them where they were just day laborers, basically, for comics. They just drew comics and had no say, no. I mean, they drew the stories. They let them create, but they're like, but we own this. I mean, that sucks.
I realized that there was not a work-for-hire contract in place when it came to Neil Gaiman on the Angel issue. I still think that Neil Gaiman is an asshole for expecting to make all this money, because he never was going to make that much money on Sandman. I know he's never made that much money off Sandman compared to what he was able to make off of one fucking issue of Spawn and then a later miniseries. And Todd fucked up because he didn't make sure that he should have put everything on paper. And then when Gaiman wanted to put shit on paper, and was willing to put shit on paper that wouldn't have necessarily been as super beneficial to him, McFarlane should have jumped at that shit. He was pigheaded, he was arrogant, he fucked up, and he got fucking ripped to shreds. Anal leakage, you know. He had a prolapse rectum after the fucking courts were done with his ass. So whatever fucking misdeeds you can attribute to Todd McFarlane, he fucking paid his debt to society for that shit. He paid his debt and more to Neil Gaiman. He saw his creations or co-creations get sold off to fucking Marvel into slavery. Marvel's fucking doing whatever the fuck they want to with Angela, a character that he designed at the very least. You're not going to tell me that Neil Gaiman designed Angela. The visuals that you see every time there's a cover with Angela on it, that's not Neil Gaiman's work. That's Todd McFarlane's creation.
Oh, they've kind of stepped further away. It's, from Marvel. They've stepped away from the look.
It doesn't make them enough money. It's not worth the trouble for them to produce Angela comics if they're not going to make a bunch of money off of it. There may be some complications with the rights. I don't think so. I think they just have it outright.
Yeah.
But maybe they don't want to have to deal with McFarlane jumping up and down and saying, that's mine. Because again, we have the Spawn movie that's in the works now. McFarlane has basically said he hopes that the Venom movie does well. Because if the Venom movie does well, then when the Spawn movie comes out, they can say by the creator of Venom, since he's a co-creator of Venom. And he thought, you know, maybe one of these days it'd be great, since it's Sony and not Marvel, he could work a deal out with Sony where Spawn and Venom could team up in a movie someday, which I think would be fucking awesome. I don't think it'll ever happen.
I think
the Marvel would fucking shut down the fucking Spider-Man Sony, deal before they
when Venom crashes and burns, and if the next and the next Spider-Man movie doesn't do as well because Marvel's not as involved.
What do you mean the first one that Sony doesn't do?
What do you mean?
You said the next Spider-Man movie.
Well, yeah, apparently, isn't the next one Sony and not Marvel?
No, the Far From Home is being filmed now.
By
it's
Marvel,
it's
going to
come
right?
out after the next Avengers movie.
Okay.
And it's going to be released as part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Okay, so then, so the next Spider-Man movie by Sony, which will be a reboot or some bullshit.
I don't know that it will. They'd be very unintelligent for them to do that.
I mean,
they're doing everything they can because they want Venom to tie into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Marvel has repeatedly said nah to that, but then there's also the rumor that Tom Holland has filmed some stuff for the Venom movie. So there's a lot of back and forth on whether or not that's a deal or not. I think that there's probably something that still needs to be hashed out between Marvel and Sony, because they both go back and forth on whether or not Venom's going to count.
We'll see.
According to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, Infinity debuted on October the 16th, 1992, as the star of the first ever Extra Image Presents, a planned floating anthology feature in their titles. However, Shadowhawk number 2 featured the second part of the story, and the first part in Brigade number 2 shipped a week later on October 23rd, 1992. No Image title shipped in November of 1992, but Infinity was backed relatively early on December 4th, 1992, as a backup feature in Supreme number 1. In typical Image fashion, the final chapter was delayed until March 16th, 1993, where it remained in Supreme number 2. You read the story of Infinity. Can you tell us what happened in that book? Or in those chapters, I should say.
At the very beginning, there's some kind of faceless robotic creature that it seems to have escaped some institution. It's like teleporting or
faceless, but it has something resembling a head and arms. It's onyx colored, and it's wearing a brown trench coat. There's no legs, and it's referred to as Enigma.
Enigma. Well, he doesn't say the name until later on when he meets Infinity, but I thought Ziggy from like Quantum Leap type thing. Like apparently it's leaping. Is it leaping through time the story made like no fucking sense. Infinity shows up.
Yeah, before. Okay, so what? Enigma shows up,
and he's got
this circle thing, this techno ball thing, like one of the variations on the Rubik's Cube, and he shoves it into a matrix where there's a bunch of clones. It might have been at Gate Industries that Star Labs knockoff that they had that was in the Liefeld titles. So he shoves this ball into one of the cloning beds, and then Infinity bursts out. It's a red redheaded woman in a white suit. She basically looks like Jean Grey.
I thought it was one of the already the Youngblood characters.
Nah.
Fahrenheit, or didn't have like Fahrenheit or Fernsight or Firmtide?
Yeah, they did have some of those, but
Firm Blight, some shit like that.
Oh, it's Infinity with an I, two I's, I should say. Yeah, but she just looked like Jim Lee's version of Jean Grey, and
looks like any other Youngblood character, female Youngblood character.
Yeah. So what happens?
So she pops up
fully formed in costume.
I don't know. The story wasn't really coherent, dude, because it went from like her showing up and not knowing anything of her past. Her
and
mind
then, like,
is white.
Fly up into space.
She grabs them and Enigma, Enigma, and they're flying into space. And
before she stops, and is like, okay, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm doing. How did we manage to get near halfway to the moon?
Yeah,
let's go back to Earth.
They come back to Earth, and then we're introduced to Ripcord.
Yeah, who's this assassin dude? So there's this Senator Edward Reif, and he is trying to expose the misdeeds of a former CIA director named Jedediah Hagstrom. This is announced in a guest appearance by Spawn's Connie Chung.
Yeah.
Alike. And basically, this senator guy is trying to expose that this ex-CIA director was working with terrorist organizations. And in order to stop him, they hire Ripcord, who's supposed to get extra money by being discreet and not letting anybody know that he was assassinating the senator. Except when he does go for the senator, he does it in public during a speech so that everybody sees this dude. And he makes a point of introducing himself as Ripcord to the media. Yeah. So that was money well spent.
He's attacking, and Infinity comes to his rescue and begins to fight Ripcord.
And they drop a building on Ripcord, and I think he dies in the end.
Well, no, she rips his arm off.
Oh, no, I think that she dropped the building off of him, and then she picks up the arm after she squished it.
Oh, okay, I thought she had ripped his arm off. And then she's like, oh, I don't know who I am or what I'm supposed to do, but I guess I'm supposed to protect you, Senator. And the Senator's like looking at the Washington Monument.
It's taking place in like around Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and he looks at it, and they're looking into the setting sun, and I'm assuming she's a protector of D.C. now?
Yeah, I think I've got a proposition for you. And they set it up as though she's going to be like working with the senator to do good deeds and shit.
I think they even, at one point, Ripcord throws a barb at her saying, I've always wanted to fight one of you Youngblood chicks.
Well, he did. It didn't work out for him. So what were her powers?
I assumed she was like a Supreme type character.
Okay, maybe so what does that mean in terms of powers?
I think
then?
She flew. She had super strength. I don't remember any lasers out of her eyes. But I could be incorrect because that was really harsh artwork. Like,
it was all right. It wasn't terrible or anything. It wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible. It was all right. It was very much of the image school.
Serviceable at best.
They actually bothered with shit like backgrounds. You got to give them credit for that.
I mean, they drew feet, so I was shocked there.
I began my love affair with comics right here in Washington after my dad had been stationed at McCord Air Force Base. My family had relocated to Tacoma. I was 6. I was what we call a reluctant reader. But one afternoon, my parents handed me my first comics in a last-ditch effort to engage me during the final stretch of a seemingly endless cross-country move. And within months, I no longer had to be coaxed into reading. I wanted to read. When I was growing up in Tacoma, I had the good fortune of going to school in one of the most diverse and welcoming environments I've ever known. After my family left Tacoma, we moved on to North Carolina, and then to Germany, and then California. By the time I got to California, I knew that I wanted to work in comics, but there weren't a whole lot of options. I'd read enough about Jack Kirby, Siegel and Shuster to know that there had to be more to comics than the two publishers that had dominated everything for so long. And I'd grown up reading superhero comics, but as a young adult, I refused to believe that that was all there was. Unfortunately, there were a group of popular artists who didn't care much for the way things were either.
Newly minted partner Robert Kirkman and publisher Eric Stevenson had a simple strategy to turn Image into the HBO of comics.
I wanted to attract better talent. I wanted to put out better books. I wanted to change the way people regarded Image Comics. But yeah, we kind of put together a list of people that we wanted to get. Oh, who was on that list? Brian K. Vaughan, Grant Morrison, Mark Miller, Matt Fraction, Rick Remender. Wanted to get him. We wanted to get Ed Brubaker. The only person that was on my list that we could not get was Alan Moore.
The way I look at it is, a couple years ago, I think we were like the 5th publisher behind Dark Horse and IDW. But that year was a better year for us than the year before. Mm. And really, the main thing I'm concerned with is how we do from year to year. Our biggest competitor is what we did before. I'm looking at, when I started was 2008, and for me it's like, did we do better than that year? Did we do better than the year before? That's what I'm concerned with.
When you and Eric Larson took over as basically co-publishers of Image Comics, I had a lot of creators, a lot of all levels, call me up and say, what do you think about that? Is that a good idea? You know, Eric Stevenson's kind of like this indie guy, and his sensibilities seem to be over there. And I was like, I think you're a little mistaken. I mean, he used to work with Rob Liefeld. He's a lover of comics. Yeah, but he's what was that? You published that anthology based on that English band that you like so much.
Balanced Sebastian. Yeah.
Yeah, he's like, he always the Balanced Sebastian
guy. Yeah, but we sold like 15,000 of those, man, and right out of the gate.
And there were like all these words like, oh, it's just going to, you know, it's going to hurt image. And here you are, 4 years later, yeah, and firing on all cylinders, and all the creators that are working for you are bringing your A game. And interestingly, and I will never say who, some of those creators who called me and asked if it was going to be okay are working for Image today.
Well, it's just weird because, I mean, I don't know if you and I personally have talked about this before, but I know I have talked about it before and I've written about it. But when I was growing up, all I read was Marvel Comics. And I'm not ashamed to say that. Up through, I don't know, like the mid to late 80s, that was all I was into. When I stopped reading comics at that point, and I went to college, I came back to comics at a certain point, Marvel was what brought me back in. I have a huge enthusiasm for superheroes and for science fiction and all kinds of stuff. But the main thing is I love all kinds of comics. I am a comic book fan. I'm not a fan of a specific company, a specific genre. I just like comics. And yeah, I heard some of that myself, and it was just one of those things where it's like, wow, you don't really know me very well.
So the character was created by Eric Stevenson and Richard Ori. Richard Ori is best known as a colorist. Along with his wife, Tanya, he's worked at DC and Marvel and did so up until around 2015. He actually did coloring on a number of the New 52 books. Before that, he was a penciler and inker. He did so exclusively for Image and primarily for Liefeld's Extreme Studios / Maximum Press / Awesome. Eric Stevenson was the writer of the project. Now, he worked with Rob Liefeld and Jim Valentino in the proto Image days before Image Comics actually existed. He was there like helping them move into offices and shit when Extreme was getting formed. He contributed to Extreme Studios from the very beginning as a writer and an editor. He also worked under both Jim Valentino and Eric Larson during their 10 years running Image Central before ultimately succeeding them. He has been the editorial head of Image Comics since 2008. He was nominated for an Eisner for his writing on the series Nowhere Man, and most recently he wrote They Are Not Like Us. Did you ever read that book?
No.
It's actually pretty good. It's sort of like, what if Stephen King wrote the New Mutants? Or it also reminded me a little bit of Psi-Force. Basically, it was like, what if you'd done the X-Men, but done it more realistically, and done it with the type of metaphysical stuff that you had being explored in the 70s and 80s. Telepathy, telekinesis, precognition, I think some pyrokinesis was in the mix. And so basically you had this group of kids that had been gathered by this one rich dude to all live in a house together and explore their powers, but the one dude was kind of like wanting to control them, and he's sort of a bad dude, and they end up turning up against him, and they're like government agencies are after them and shit. So it very much feels like Stephen King stuff in the early 80s, like Firestarter and Carrie.
Kind of sounded almost like John Byrne's Next Men.
I can see a little bit of that in there too.
Yeah.
I liked it. I bought the two trades that came out. It ended before they came out with the third trade. And I liked it enough to where I bought the second trade and I intended to buy the third trade, but I can't tell you the names of any of the characters. I forgot most of the specifics of the plot. So it was solid. It was good enough to get me to keep buying it. But the fact that they never came out with the third trade.
I'll borrow yours and take a look at it.
And then he also did Nowhere Men, which I've never read. I've got the trade. I actually brought it with me. So if you want to read it later, I'll kick it your way. He ended up doing some pretty good stuff later on. He's obviously been hugely important to Image Comics, though, because he's the one who really set them on the path to becoming the third biggest publisher in the country. And now that DC's moved out of the previous catalog, that's like their premier book that's still in the actual catalog. Because I don't know if you noticed, they reorganized the previous catalog where Image is now at the very front of the book.
I haven't looked.
You were going to say something, though?
Oh, no. Just when you kept saying Nowhere Man, I kept thinking of the Beatles song.
Earlier this year, 2018, Eric Stevenson was named to the Image Board of Directors. So he's the first member of the Board of Directors, of Image Partner, who is actually created by Image, who came up through the Image system, has worked mostly at Image Comics. And so you're wondering, why did we cover Infinity?
Yes.
Well, I'll give you some landmarks. She is the 9th Image solo strip to appear in their own comic book story, because both Pitt and Bloodstrike debuted as pinups, and they hadn't had stories yet by the time she debuted. She's the first Image property created by a non-founder. She is the first co-created by a writer, who also ended up becoming a Image Partner. Retroactively, she's the first character created by an Image Partner known as being a writer foremost. She's a first property created exclusively by Image Comics talent. She's the first solo Image heroine. They'd never had had a female character leading one of their books up to the point that Infinity was created. She's a second Image property with a non-white creator because the Wildcats were created by two Koreans. Yeah. And I believe that Richard Ori is Japanese. The name itself is Japanese. And from pictures, he's not a Caucasian. And it's tied with Wildcats for the third completed initial Image story arc. You know, at the Savage Dragon miniseries had ended by that point, and the first arc of Spawn had ended. So she got a complete story almost sooner than anybody else. Mm-hmm. She also, of course, had some problems because this was the first Image story created by untested, no-name creators. She has no actual origin story, but they didn't make sure to give her a logo.
Yeah.
I guess her powers are flight, energy blast, and maybe she's a super seamstress because at one point she's looking at an outfit in a shop window and then she materialized that outfit on her. I don't know if she created it from scratch, if she teleported it, if she could become a material. It doesn't say. There's no actual story here. There's just a fight and she just sort of turns up. There's no actual characters here. Nothing's done with any of these people. I hated that they have those high-tech grunts that show up out of nowhere and they've got like all this armor and shit. They might as well be Cobra or Stormtroopers because they don't do anything. They just happen. Like, everybody had to be like super high-tech in the Image books. You couldn't just be a thug with a gun or something. So it was already like a cliche by the time Infinity showed up. Not a great character. Never appeared again. She never was explored in any way, even though she had some loose ties to the Extreme Universe and to Youngblood specifically. But she is an important character in the history of Image Comics, or at least an important footnote, I would say. So I just wanted to give her a little bit of attention because last year when I went to Heroes Con, I decided since it was the 25th anniversary of Image Comics that I was going to get a jam and have alternative comics creators that predated the Image creators draw the Image characters sort of in honor of Image. Of course, a lot of these guys didn't give a rat's ass about Image Comics and hated the guys who made up Image Comics. So I think a few of these dudes, particularly Los Brothers Hernandez, were not thrilled to be working on the Image characters for me, but they did it and I appreciated that.
Were they pretty cool? The Hernandez brothers?
I don't think that they were thrilled to be drawing Image characters requested by me. And I didn't come up to them telling them how much I loved Love and Rockets. Yeah. So there was not like a mutual love fest between the two of us. But in typical Image fashion, the piece is not quite done yet. And at the end, I turned it over to Evan Dorkin. And Evan Dorkin has like gone crazy with all these background materials, you know, adding all these different characters and stuff to basically complete the piece. But it's also been over a year now and it's still being worked on. So it's So it's definitely an Image jam because it's going to come out like on the 26th or 27th anniversary. It'll probably, because I want to get it colored. So it'll probably, by the time I get it back from Dorkin and get it colored, it'll be like the 28th anniversary.
Does he know he still has it?
Oh yeah. I just talked to him last week about it. All right. You know, yeah. So, but yeah, he's done great stuff. I'm not at all, you know, and I paid him nothing. I need to pay him more money because he put so much work into it that the pittance that I paid him is nowhere near enough for the effort.
Well, I still have that original.
Because, I mean, he completely filled out the entire background with characters, including I asked him after the fact, well after Heroes Con, can you add Infinity? Because even though she's obviously a footnote character to the point where I didn't even realize she existed, and I was trying to put something from all the major Image founders, including representation for Robert Kirkman, who became a founder years later as well. So Infinity is in the piece. I just felt like she deserved acknowledgement, and I knew this episode was going to run long talking about the Spawn movie and Spawn 10, so Infinity is our backup filler for this particular episode.
But just real quick, I do have a Evan Dorkin piece that when I met him back in like 95, 94, 96, around there, and I walked up and he was promoting his Predator book that he did, which I've never read.
He wrote it, yeah.
I think I read that. It was like a Cannibal Predator or something like that.
It's been, I think it was in Louisiana or something. It's been a long time.
Yeah, so he wrote that, and I asked him, I love milk and cheese. Can you please draw just a little picture of milk and cheese for me? And I gave him this big ass cardboard and he filled the entire page with milk and cheese.
Yeah.
And everyone after, and he goes, I do one per show. First person asks gets one. And man, I had so many fucking offers. I've still had offers for like people because it's milk and cheese running at you. I mean, just thought I'd throw that
in. One of the first things I told him when I asked him to contribute to the commission, because I specifically approached him about Savage Dragon, and what that was before he was going to draw all the other characters as well. But the first thing I told him was that my buddy had had a piece by him for years. I've been envious all these years, and I wanted to finally match up and get a piece by Evan Dorkin. So we both have pieces now, and I'm pleased as
punch. He was cool as shit when I met him.
I did not converse with any of the creators that created Dorkin. I mean, him, we had a great little conversation. Even Paquita had a great conversation with him. It was a fun little powwow.
But
so
I got you beat even more.
And I ran into him in a hotel later on. We were all going to the same restaurant and shit. So
I got you beat even more because I met Terry Moore that same day, and Terry Moore was writing his two characters?
Strangers in Paradise.
Strangers in Paradise. Hadn't even been done yet. He had the prelim artwork inked and everything and wanted to show it to Evan Dorkin. And some guy named Bob, who was from one of the, I think Dark Horse, was there. He was like with Evan Dorkin, was showing them that. And I remember they grabbed him, and because people were like looking at the artwork and like, well, will you sell this artwork? Like people wanted to buy pages off him. And Terry Moore was like, well, I haven't really produced this yet, so I don't know if I can sell it yet. And but I remember Bob telling them, stop, you're coming with us. And they took him. And I got to be Terry Moore before he became somebody.
That's cool.
Yeah. So he was there with Evan Dorkin. And Evan Dorkin, he basically took his pages to get, I guess, like reviewed, like, what do you think? And I remember Evan Dorkin was like, wait right here, let me go get Bob. Like they knew they had something there. And then within,
well, ultimately he published through Abstract, a self-published company. But he did have a stint at Image Comics.
Terry Moore from here?
Yeah, he's Houstonian.
Yeah, that's what I thought that was.
And again, Image Strange the Paradise did ultimately get Image published under the Wildstorms. I think they're Homage Studios imprint for a while, but it went back to Abstract before too long.
Oh, okay. So,
or you know what? It might have been at Antarctic for a little bit when it first got started.
Say Antarctic,
yeah, I think it was at Antarctic, which is a San Antonio company that's best known for manga. And then he moved to Image, and then he ultimately landed at his own Abstract Studios.
So just to put a cherry on top of my story. In my artwork.
Well, you're hijacking my story about Evan Dorkin and about Infinity.
We both whipped them out. You just didn't realize I had rolled mine and I had another foot to go.
Wait till you see the Evan Dorkin piece, motherfucker.
But mine's an original. Milk and cheese.
I mean, it's not the first Hellboy work that you've done. You did some work in Hellboy Will Tale.
For the anthology, yeah. But it's the first time that I have begged and pleaded with Mike Mignola to save my miserable life. I tried to get Batman. Apparently, you have to beg to a lot more people because it's a corporation. So I fished around for, like, where can I beg to just one guy? And I swung it. I'll be working as Mike's personal valet for about 4 months after the book comes out. That's going to be tough. I've never really worked as a butler / chauffeur / gopher / whipping post for a cartoonist before. It's going to be very interesting. I'm going to California, and I'm going to wear the chauffeur outfit. In fact, the actual chauffeur outfit from Some Kind of Wonderful, the John Hughes film. I will be wearing that while working for the Mignola family. It's going to suck, because I hear Mike's cranky.
And I heard...
I'm not kidding. All right? So, I want you to start crying for me, because I'm fucked. It could be worse. It could be like Neil Adams' indentured servant for a week, and he'd send me to Pellucidar to get, you know, evidence on the lizard people who expand the universe. You know all about that? Neil Adams thinks rocks grow. This guy's hip. What do you give him the microphone and you take this sneaky pee-pee camera? So, your next question that I won't listen to.
So what do we think about the Spawn movie?
Again, first time director. I can do it.
Micro budget, $10 to $12 million.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be The Spirit Part 2.
I hope not.
I watched The Spirit one time. That's... My soul ached afterwards. It was so bad. Like, I thought if you could write a comic book, you should be able to direct a video game type movie. And it was a waste of Samuel L. Jackson. It was bad, dude. Like, dialogue wise, even, it was just fucking bad. It was a train wreck. I'd rather have seen that fucking Sky Captain movie again.
Yeah, Sky Captain: The World of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Also a really bad
movie. Fucking horror.
Yeah, McFarlane, the last time I read McFarlane writing, because I've read Spawn since then, but it was being written by Eric Larson at the time. And before that, I was reading the David Hein run. When I tried to read the Todd McFarlane, Simone Kazirski run, whatever that was, it was some of the worst fucking comic books I've ever read in my life. It was fucking horrible. I bought those comics for like 25, 50 cents a piece, and I wanted a refund. You know, it was so it was terrible. Boring and ugly and stupid and just bad all around, but mainly boring. So I fear that that's what we're going to get with the Spawn movie, that it's going to be Sam and Twitch. It's like, I'm not showing up for Sam and Twitch. Get the fuck out of here with that shit. But my understanding is they're trying to do something hard R.
They want to do a horror movie.
I suspect it's going to be kind of a 70 kind of thing going on.
Like a grindhouse?
Huh?
Like a grindhouse type film or?
No, like Seven.
Oh, like 7. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Where it's going to be kind of dark, but not big budget dark, and maybe a little CGI for when Spawn shows up as maybe the person who's going to bring to justice whoever's the people that Sam and Twitch are going after. I hope it's good. I'm definitely rooting for it. Given that we have a show about Spawn, I definitely see us going to the theater and seeing the Spawn movie when it comes out and hopefully showing our support. But I'm not optimistic about it being good.
I have a lot of reservations for it. I feel his ego is pushing him to do this. If he was smart, he would have said, "Hey, look, I got these writers that wrote these great horror movies and we worked on the script together. I've worked with this director guy to kind of learn." Like, he's done none of that. He's just like, "I'm going to make this movie. And I feel like we're going to get a fucking TV movie." Like, he literally just sit in front of the camera, point the camera and say, like, the I think he's going to be like the famous Lucas thing. I feel it's going to be a famous Lucas scene where it's like, "Faster. No. Slower." With dialogue and shit. Like, I don't see him. He's never directed anything.
I know, but I think he's the kind of guy who's going to sit there and I think
either he's going to try to be like a fucking Scorsese or some shit, which he can't. He hasn't built up to. Or I don't know, man. I
really think that you're underestimating the point. I realize.
No, I'm giving him his due. His thing is all about, I could do this, but he hasn't proven anything.
Well, he did direct some animation, though. You know, he directed that Pearl Jam music video. He's done some animation. But you also have to appreciate one of the reasons why Robert Rodriguez was getting Frank Miller involved with the Sin City movies is he recognized that the comics had essentially storyboarded the movie. All he had to do was shoot the storyboards, and he had a movie already.
Yeah, we did that with 300.
But he got Frank Miller after Frank Miller had basically burnt out and ceased to have any talent at anything, right? And there's no indication that Miller was a guy who could direct people, who could interact with people, because he was a guy who hid behind a drawing board all day fucking long. McFarlane has spent the last 20 years plus running companies. He's a mogul. He's run video operations. He's run animation studios. He's worked with HBO and cut deals with HBO. He's worked with the distributors for his toys. He works with retailers. He has to deal with people all the time. He's somebody who is probably going to be vulgar and he's probably going to say inappropriate things perhaps, but I think he's somebody who can tell an actor, okay, well, I want this out of you. Now, the tricky part might be he might say something that'll offend the actors and piss them off and stuff, but the fact is he's not going to be working with very many name actors anyway. The only one I know of right now is Jimmy Fox, and Jimmy Fox is not going to be in the movie that much. You got to figure he's probably going to be in the movie for like 10 minutes at most. A very small part, probably. The expectation is he'll be in the movie more as if they make more of them, but there's only going to be so much of him. So I don't see where McFarlane wouldn't be able to work with actors, and he's somebody who has a visual sense. He will probably put the camera in interesting places. You don't need a big budget to put a camera in an interesting place. You look at the Sam Raimi movies. Raimi, of course, is a genius director. Mm-hmm. I'm not ascribing those talents to McFarlane, but the fact that he knows how to tell a story visually, I think that he could probably direct a movie. I don't know if it'll be a good movie, but I think he has the capacity. I don't think it's going to be a situation where like he's doing a Kevin Smith kind of thing where he just sets a camera down and tells people to start talking. I think that he can direct people, and I think that he can put a camera in places that'll be interesting.
He wrote the script, right?
But he did write the script, and he's not a great writer. I get that. But I think that he might be a good enough writer for TV. Or movies. You look at the shit. I mean, I'm sorry, but I've watched enough episodes of the Spawn cartoon. That's not a great. That show is not well written. But it sells itself through the visuals, through the music, through the style.
It's a violent sexual cartoon.
Right. So you do a violent, sexy movie, and that can still be entertaining. It doesn't have to be high art. I actually think that his style and his sensibilities would translate better to film than they do in the comic page these days. I don't think that he's daring enough in what he's trying to do in the comics, especially when he was doing the shit with the white dude. I don't remember his name right now, but when he was doing that run of books, that could work better on screen than it does in comics. So I'm not saying I think it's going to be a great movie, but I'm hopeful because I can see that he's got the skill set to where it could be all right. It could be pretty decent. I think that I have more optimism for McFarlane than I would have had for Miller even back then. We didn't know how bad Miller was going to get back when he did The Spirit, but I think that McFarlane has already demonstrated that he has more skills necessary to direct a movie than Miller had.
I
think he showed more screenwriting chops too, because one of the problems that Miller had when he was trying to be a screenwriter is he kept writing for comic book budgets. Comic books have an unlimited budget, where like when he did the RoboCop movies, he wrote so much shit that didn't translate well to screen or would have cost a bunch of money. They ended up taking his script and breaking it up into two different fucking movies so they at least get budgets for those two movies. So I think that McFarlane has a more realistic idea, in part because he has to deal with money all the fucking time. time. He can manage people. I think you're underestimating what he can do. That doesn't mean he's going to do anything good in terms of film. I just don't think it's fair to underestimate him. And I really think you're too hard about, like, oh, he's fucked over all these people. It's like, most of the people he fucked over, one of the reasons why he got into trouble is because they were also moneyed people that could go after his ass with lawyers. Tony Twist went after his ass because he did something stupid. He named a character Tony Twist, which was the actual legal name of an athlete who had millions of dollars to sue his ass with. And so he went to court, and it cost him a boatload of money for lawyers. It cost him a boatload of money in settlement fees because he ended up getting something like a $15 million judgment against him that became a $5 million budget. I'm not saying McFarlane hasn't done some stupid shit, just like spending $5 million on a baseball that ended up being worthless a year later. But he had the money at the time to be stupid with his money. I don't think he can be stupid with his money now. And that was 15, 20 years ago. One would hope that he would have done more with himself since then and smartened up since then. So don't be so hard on the guy. He's never fucked people over the way that the big corporations have. He pissed off Brian Michael Bendis by being a dick to him by firing him off of Stan Twitch when he found that he had jumped ship to go work at Marvel. Well, that's a dick move, but it's not like he's taking away his creations and not spending and giving him any money for it and shit like that. I mean, I think McFarlane's made mistakes, but I don't think he's necessarily that bad of a guy to where he could in any way be compared to the fuckery of the companies. What do we think about Jamie Foxx? Keith G. Baker specifically asked us about that.
He's an actor. I mean, he's not a great actor.
You don't like Jamie Foxx?
Every movie he plays in, he's Jamie Foxx.
Right?
Yeah. No, he's still Jamie Foxx. He's doing an interpretation of Ray. Like, okay, so you'll watch a movie. It's a period piece like that, say, based on a character. There's certain movies that when you watch the character, like Tanya, best example. I just watched it not too long ago. I fucking forgot that's fucking Harley Quinn on the goddamn screen. I watched it. I thought that was fucking halfway. There's times I'm like, is this footage from like a news? She was amazing. I really, really believe that was her. I forgot that wasn't Tanya Harding. And I know what Tanya Harding looks like because I remember that whole situation. The way she spoke, talked. It was amazing. Amazing. I watched Ray. It was like someone doing it was like Eddie Murphy when he does an impersonation. Yeah. I didn't believe that was Ray Charles. It was just somebody doing an impersonation.
Okay.
I've seen some of his other movies. I mean, he's just Jamie Foxx. It's Jamie Foxx is this guy. I don't ever watch him and say, wow, no, that's not his fault. He's just, you know, he's a bankable actor. He's usually comedic. I can't think of the last movie I saw him in.
Well, I like Jamie Foxx. I wouldn't call myself a fan necessarily, but I've really enjoyed him in some movies. I thought he was great in Jarhead. And of course, Django Unchained, fucking awesome movie. And he's great in it. And it's funny to me to think that Tarantino wanted Will Smith for that because Will Smith could have never pulled that off where Jamie Foxx could. I think that Jamie Foxx is a really good choice to play Al Simmons. I think that he could pull that off very well. And my understanding is the way that Todd McFarlane was able to get Jamie Foxx to sign on in part was the simple fact that Foxx is apparently a fan of Spawn. There's a picture that was going around years ago where McFarlane drew a head sketch of Spawn for Fox. McFarlane explained that if you sign on to do the Spawn movie now, you're only going to be in the first Spawn movie a little bit. The way that I'm setting this up, you don't have to be like Chris Evans where you're going to have to stay in peak physical condition the whole time. You know, Spawn's a character that's in the shadows. You're going to have stuntman. You're going to have CGI. You're not going to have to be this physical presence. The suit and your acting is all that you need. And so you're going to be able to play this character of Spawn if it's a success for years and years. You could play this character for another 15 years into your career. And Jamie Foxx is into his 40s now, I believe. So that was a big selling point, is they're going to make more of these things and he's going to be this character for movie after movie. I think that he's got a decent enough voice. He's obviously not Keith David, but who is?
No.
But he's got the physical presence. I think he can act the character. In some ways, I mean, as much as I like Michael Jai White, because it's so awesome to have a dude who's actually a martial artist and who's actually a big muscular dude who can do what a superhero is supposed to do in his movies. But he's not the strongest of actors. I think that Jamie Foxx is a stronger actor. And more importantly, I think he has more of a screen presence. I don't think that Jai White acts to other actors. I think Michael Jai White has this big performance and that's what carries him, is he's this big physical presence. Jamie Foxx can actually interact with other actors and respond to them, react to them. And I think that because of his swagger, the way that he carries himself, he has a very Simmonsy quality to him. So I think it's actually an excellent bit of casting. And Jamie Foxx is a guy who never got to do the superhero franchise. For the most part, has he ever even had a franchise?
No.
And I think he deserves one. And I think that Spawn is a good pick for him. But here's one of the stumbling blocks. The sexual assault allegations.
No.
What do you think about those? Did you hear about that?
No.
There was a woman in Las Vegas who said...
Oh, yeah. They smacked her with his dick or some shit like that, right?
Do you remember any more of that?
No. Somebody was making a joke about it. I overheard. Like on some radio show or something. That he used his penis as a battering ram or some shit like that. Or I don't know. Tapped her on the shoulder or some shit. I don't know.
In Las Vegas, I think 10 or 15 years ago, she's at a party. party with Jamie Foxx. Jamie Foxx's people brings her over to come hang out with him. At some point, his penis made a presentation, and he basically was trying to get her to suck his dick. And she refused, and at some point, he slapped her in the face with his dick. And so, 10 to 15 years later, she went to the Las Vegas Police Department and reported him because she wanted to make sure that if he'd never been doing anything like that to anybody else, that it was on the record that he had done that, and basically as a show of support if there were any other sexual abuse allegations against Foxx. So far, none of them have come out. I'm a feminist. I'm a supporter of the Me Too movement. I don't know how she managed to run into his dick with her head. I know that Jamie Foxx has a big dick. You can see it online if you'd like.
He had
pictures that floated around there for a little bit. He can definitely get some distance with his cock. But for him to dick slap you, your face would have to be within a foot of his penis, you know, of his crotch.
Yes.
So that doesn't happen on its own. If there was a story about security forcing her face into his crotch or something, but that's not the story. He apparently whipped out his dick and slapped her with it. So she managed to get into proximity of his dick. That's all that he did. Unless anything else comes out, stay out of the way of Jamie Foxx's swinging dick.
I'm not really touching this one at all.
So yeah, I have no problem with Jamie Foxx. I actually think that he's probably a good pick as long as nothing else like that comes out, or more importantly, something worse than that needs to come out, and then I'll maybe start to think twice about that. So,
oh, okay, man. That just got really awkward at the end.
So on the Brigade episode, Monkey76 liked us on WordPress. The Angel episode got a Google Plus One from The Hammer Strikes. On Facebook, we got likes and shares from DeBeige, Richard Field, and Derek William Crabb. On Tumblr, we got attention from Zegas, which is Michelle Fife. On Twitter, we got that sweet, sweet spawning from the 108 Sage, Ali Bats, Andy M. at All Star Andy DC, Dr. Ange, Backseat Directors, The Bad Boy, Biko Django, Bone Dragon Comics, Carlos Digital, Cash Flag, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Charles Chuck Forsman, who, by the way, is the creator of the comic book End of the Effin' World, which was recently adapted at Netflix, and the Revenger series, Coffee and Comics Podcast, Dr. G Nerdologist, Ed Moore Jr., Fanholes Podcast, Gavin Higginbotham, Giddy Gus, The Hammer Strikes, History of Comics on Film, Into the Weird, which is Grant Richter's new blog, our podcast, It's Plastic Man, Jacob Proper, Jeffrey Brown, Jennifer DeRoss, Joe Crawford, John M. Wilson's podcasting again, Kashif Ali, Christados, Kyle Benning Likes Comics, Longbox Crusade, Lost in Time, Merch, Nethead, Odell Abner Dracula, Paul D. Nolan, Relatively Geeky, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard Field, Ryan Daly, Sean Michael Ortega, Sean Phillips, Siskoid, Steve Sellers, Tim Price, Toll Booth, Varangian Vigilante, and Warlord Worlds. Comments came from Dorkness to Light, who thanked us for playing their promo. Joe Crawford wrote, "Newest Spawn has the return of an old friend." Steve Sellers wrote, "I remember liking the Angela Mini quite a bit, though it's been a long time since I read it. Such a shame that everything went sour when it comes to Angela and Spawn." Derek William Crabb sent us a gif of Barry and LaVon with their $240 worth of pudding, which is from the State Sketch Show from MTV.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Jeffrey Brown wrote, "I have that issue of Spawn number 10. Now, upon my first reading in 08, I was also watching the Spawn animated series, and I do remember reading the wordy Gaiman issue. I just thought she had a cool design, but like most things, I didn't get the action figure in the 90s. And Keith G. Baker wrote, "Any thoughts on Electro playing this part, Rolled Spine?"
Oh, yeah, I forgot Jamie Foxx was Electro.
I think we all need to forget that Jamie Foxx was Electro. That was fucking wretched. I still think that Amazing Spider-Man 2 is one of the worst superhero movies of all time.
I don't know. We just watched Man Thing.
Hey there. Welcome to the Mirror Factory. I'm the foreman, Max Romero, so let me tell you a little bit about what we do here. The Mirror Factory is a podcast where we talk about your favorite passages from novels, novellas, and short stories. Each episode features a different guest who will tell us a little about the book their passage is from and why it means so much to them. Then that guest will give us a special reading of their favorite passage for our listeners. If you think you'd like to be a guest in the Mirror Factory, drop us a line at Factory Mirror on Twitter, The Mirror Factory on Facebook, or at mirrorfactorypodcast@gmail.com. The Mirror Factory is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Oop, time to get back to work. Until next time, read a book.
Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr. If you're a history lover or a musical lover, you probably know about both Hamilton and Burr's rise to power in the early stages of American history and their infamous duel. But what if you didn't know the full story? What if one of them was a werewolf? White Rocket Entertainment proudly presents a 48-page full-color comic book, Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale. Written by Jared Albrecht, the yard sale artist, art by Nate Niles, colors by Ace Wheely and Ken Solomon, letters by Percival Constantine, and edited by Johanna Albrecht. Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale. Available digitally on Kindle and Comics Central, C-O-M-I-X Central. Prefer a print copy? Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale, along with my other published works, are available at theyardsaleartist.bigcartel.com. That's theyardsaleartist.bigcartel.com. Or you can buy it directly from me, creator Jared Albrecht, the yard sale artist, at any of my Comic-Con appearances. Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale. Get your copy today. You won't regret it. Don't take my word for it. Here's what Ming Chen from AMC's TV series Comic Book Men had to say about it.
I really enjoyed it. A lot of great werewolf scenes in here. A lot of great... This is how I wish history would be told to kids. Books like Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale.
That's Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale.
Hey there, I'm Nathaniel with some exciting news about the Punch Like a Girl podcast. Oh, hey Liz, I'm just doing the promo. Tell the people about how the podcast we do together covering graphic novels and trade collections starring female protagonists is moving to, and actually I'm mansplaining again, aren't I?
Uh-huh.
Well, I can just, here you go.
Punch Like a Girl is joined in the Fire and Water Network, and as of October will be found on the network feed and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Is it okay if I just invite folks to join us in celebrating the girls who kick butt?
I think you already did.
Yes! Nailed it!
Don't worry, folks. I'll keep him in line.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials will need to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!